Running a learning business today requires attention to growing reach, generating revenue, and demonstrating real impact, all while navigating constant change and fierce competition for learners' time and money.
To help, we've curated a collection of free resources for learning business professionals. You'll find frameworks, briefings, and reports, webinars, and tools focused on strategy, portfolio design, pricing, marketing, and more, all created specifically for organizations that sell continuing education and professional development.
If you care about building a stronger, more sustainable learning business, visit leadinglearning.com/free resources.
That's leadinglearning.com/free resources for practical tools and strategic insight to help you grow your reach, revenue, and impact.
If you're a leader or an aspiring leader in the business of lifelong learning, you're in the right place. I'm Salisa Steele.
And I'm Jeff Cobb. And this is the Leading Learning Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 198 of the Leading Learning Podcast, where we talk with Scott H. Young. Scott is a widely read blogger who is known in particular for some of his remarkable self-education projects. He's also the author of the just-released book, Ultra Learning, Master Hard Skills, Outsmart the Competition, and Accelerate Your Career. Now, Jeff, I know you've been following Scott's writing for many years, so tell us, what did you talk about given the chance to chat with him in real time?
Well, it's true. I have indeed been reading Scott's work for many years, and he's just a very thoughtful and prolific writer on a wide range of topics related to learning. And as you noted, he's gained notoriety for some of the learning projects he's taken on, things like completing MIT's 4-year computer science curriculum in 12 months.
Wow.
And we talk about that and some of his other projects as part of the background experience that led to this latest project, which is his new book, Ultra Learning. And as it happens, we were able to line up this episode perfectly so that it's coming out on the very day that Ultra Learning is being officially released. And I had the chance to read a proof of the book, and I definitely recommend it to our listeners, both as a source of inspiration for their own learning, but also as a sort of practical guide to the core principles of effective learning. As you can probably guess from the title, this is a book that is about really pushing learning and our ideas about what we can learn and how fast to the limits. We also discuss how the principles that Scott covers apply to more modest learning initiatives and also how learning businesses can help their learners embrace these principles. Now, Scott is just a really very easygoing, likable guy, and he shares a number of the great stories from his life and from the book, and I think listeners are just really going to enjoy this one.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating listen. Sounds like he's done a lot, and so without further ado, let's roll the interview with Scott H. Young.
Hey there, and welcome to the Leading Learning Podcast. I'm Jeff Cobb, and today I'm joined by Scott H. Young. In many ways, Scott is someone for whom a quick and concise introduction just won't do the trick. But I'll describe him as an avid and committed lifelong learner, a longtime blogger at scotthyoung.com, and author of the new book, Ultra Learning, which is subtitled Master Hard Skills, Outsmart the Competition, and Accelerate Your Career. All things I'm sure most listeners would like to do for themselves, as well as for the learners that they serve. The book should be out right about the time we release this episode, and I encourage listeners to get it. But in the meantime, we've got the author right here, so let's get going. Scott, welcome to the Leading Learning Podcast.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Well, I'm so thrilled to have you here. You know, it's exciting that this book is coming out, but besides that, I've been a longtime reader, a big fan. I really admire what you've done with your blogging and with some of your learning challenges that I'm sure we'll talk about here in a minute. And I noted
Thank
that, I noted that you kind of defy the usual descriptions. So I'd like to ask you, you know, how do you describe yourself and the work that you do?
Oh, I'm really bad at self-promotion. So I got to say that's been a question that has vexed me for 13 years is when people say, what do you do? How do I answer that? I think what I've been saying during these podcasts is that I like to do sort of unusual self-education projects. And so this has been sort of what I've been doing for the last, 10 years or so. Things like I did the MIT Challenge, which was a project to learn MIT's 4-year computer science curriculum using just their free online resources, which I did over 12 months. I did another project with a friend, which we called The Year Without English, where we traveled to four countries to learn four different languages. I've done projects to learn portrait drawing, quantum mechanics, all sorts of things like this. And writing this book was not just about documenting some of the things that have worked for me, but also finding this diverse group of what I call ultra learners, who are these people who take on these really sort of intriguing and impressive efforts to get good at something in unusual ways. And so there are people who have much more dramatic and interesting stories than my own that I document in the book. And I wanted to try to pull together some of the principles that go into how they're able to learn and master hard skills quickly, so that, you know, people who are listening to this right now can apply those same ideas to their own life, to their own careers, and in the case of this podcast, to the people that they're trying to teach.
Well, and I definitely want to get to, you know, some of the stories and the lessons in the book and the book in general in a minute here. Obviously, I've been enjoying reading it. It's great material. But before we even get there, I mean, you've said, you know, you've been writing about this for years. You've been doing all of these sort of experiments with your own learning. You're obviously incredibly passionate about learning. Why? What's the source of that?
Well, you know, it's funny because I think I've always been a curious person. I've always liked learning new things. So this has always been something that has intrigued me. But one of the things that really, I think, went from that being a curiosity, which I think many of the people here can also resonate with, to something that, you know, this was an obsession, was really an introduction that was made to me about 10 years ago. So I was a college student and I was doing an exchange in France. And I was trying to learn French, and it wasn't going super well. I was doing sort of mediocrely in my French class. I think I even got a D on the final exam. And most of the people around me spoke to me in English, including the French ones. And I really was kind of struggling. And I think, like a lot of people in that situation, it's easy to say, well, you know, maybe this just isn't enough time. Or, you know what, actually, most people who go on exchange don't learn the language. That was what I found when I interviewed people who had gone on before. So it's easy to just say, you know what, maybe it's just too hard, or maybe I can't do it. And around this time, I was introduced to a guy, the first ultra learner who I sort of encountered meeting in the book, I recall, that his name was Benny Lewis. And he's sort of become famous now for his Fluent in 3 Months projects, where he tries to go to a new country and learn a new language from scratch in as little as 3 months, trying to learn as much as possible. And I was kind of blown away, not just by his results, because he has like videos of him after 3 months and you're like, well, that's a lot better than I was doing after 3 months, but also his whole philosophy towards learning, which I think really epitomizes this ultra learning concept of not only taking on the initiative for your own learning efforts. So instead of just passively waiting to be told what to do from teachers or from the environment, being active about deciding what you want to learn and how you're going to learn it. But then also sort of going a little bit further than most people would, pursuing somewhat more aggressive or intense methods in order to get those results. And one of the recurring patterns I've seen, not only in my own life, but also in the cognitive science, is that very often the effective method for learning does involve a little bit more discomfort, a little bit more frustration. I think our brains are naturally averse to putting in effort that creates learning. And so we often want to switch down to an activity that will be easier and more comforting. And that's a delusion, or that's a little bit of a shortcut that you can kind of preserve in your head if you don't really know what works. And so seeing, oh, this is the right way to learn things, this is much more effective, once you've experienced it firsthand, I mean, you just get converted and there's no other way of seeing it. And so for me, it was having that exposure to him and then later trying out my own projects that I think really convinced me that the potential to learn things and to be good at things that seem really hard for you right now is much, much more than most people realize.
Well, I think it's such a valuable lesson to learn early in life. And you started at this pretty young. I mean, you're still a fairly young guy. I think it took me far, far too long to learn that. I've done a lot with languages myself. And, you know, I've been on those sorts of exchange programs where, yeah, you walk away not really learning anywhere near what you thought you would learn. And just the whole realization that learning simply does take effort, and you have to know that for yourself. And I think for our listeners, for our audience, a lot of times they're uncomfortable making people make an effort, you know, particularly with adult learners. You don't want to push adult learners too hard, or they feel like they shouldn't. But but the learning doesn't happen without that.
I just want to weigh in because I think you brought up a really valuable point that a lot of times as educators or as people who have, you know, studied education or studied learning, there is a lot of stuff that people realize as being a teacher, okay, this works, this doesn't work. And so it's very interesting. I've had these conversations with educators after writing the book, and they say, you know, they read through some of the principles that I list in the book, and they're like, yeah, we know this. And I try to convince the students, and they don't want to do it.
Right.
And so I think for me, writing this book was that this is a book for the student, because I think as a learner, if you know, oh, this is how your mind works, this is, if you do this, you will acquire skills. If you do that, you won't. And if you can understand that, you can debug a lot of your own processes. So I think it's just unfortunate that a lot of us don't know how to learn. We haven't learned how to learn. And so we don't even realize we're doing things that aren't very effective. And instead we blame, you know, our intelligence or lack of talent or what have you.
If you want to gain insight into what's most effective for your learners, we encourage you to check out our sponsor. Authentic Learning Labs is an e-learning company that offers products and services to help improve your current investments in education. One key product is Authentic Analytics, a dedicated suite of visualization reports that help analyze and predict the performance of education programs. Organizations use Authentic Analytics to easily scan through volumes of data in intuitive visuals, chart performance trends, and quickly spot opportunities, issues, and potential future needs. Find out more at leadinglearning.com/authentic. And now back to the interview as Jeff asks Scott to talk more about his MIT challenge.
Now, I do want to jump back a little bit, though, because you skimmed over something a little bit in talking about yourself initially. And this is something you write about in the book, but it's also, I think, the thing that sort of put you on the map for me, and I think for a lot of other people, is when you undertook this MIT challenge for yourself. Can you give a little more detail on that for listeners who may not have heard about you doing that? Because was kind of insane at a certain level, and it's very impressive.
Well, thank you. Yeah. So what had happened is I had graduated from university and I had majored in business, and I was feeling a little bit like, I wasn't in love with the degree that I got. And when I was going into university, I was considering studying computer science. I'd done a little bit of programming in high school. It was something that had always interested me. But of course, you know, when you've just graduated, it's like, do you really want to take out another 4 years? Do you want to take out student loans? Do you want to delay your life just to get some more education? And so around this time, I found classes put on by MIT that were put online for free. So you can even go there now. It's called MIT OpenCourseWare, and they've got like hundreds and hundreds of classes that they've put at least some of the materials online. Some of them are complete, like they'll have lectures and assignments and exams and solutions. Some of them are incomplete. They only have some of it. And at the time I was looking through this and looking through these resources, this seemed like the perfect alternative because I already have a degree. I don't really want to go back to school. And as I was playing around with it, I realized that there's a lot of assumptions baked into how we think about going through school that are there either because of convenience or because of the student. And they're not necessarily something that you have to follow when you're going through it. So one example that I bring up a lot, I don't want to say this is the only thing that matters for doing something like this well, but if you are in a classroom sitting in lectures, you have to listen to the whole thing. And if anyone knows from sitting in lectures, you often have your mind wandering, you stop paying attention, there's that boring preamble, there's the waiting for the professor to start talking, there's getting to and from the class. There's a lot of inefficiency there. Whereas if you're watching a lecture video, you could even watch it at 1.5 times the speed. And I've said that to people, and sometimes people scoff at that. But a lot of people I know listen to podcasts at 1.5 times the speed. You very quickly get used to listening to it at a faster speed. It's totally possible to listen to my voice at, you know, 1.5 times the speed. For some speakers, even 2 times the speed if they speak particularly slowly. And so you can do that, and then suddenly what is an hour and 15-minute lecture, maybe you're getting through in 45 minutes. And if you're getting through it in 45 minutes, well, maybe there's some parts that you didn't understand, but you can always rewatch them. So that also takes some of the pressure off of note-taking, where you don't have to transcribe things verbatim. You can just, you know, try to understand the lecture and piece things together as you go back. And so there's tons of these little things that come together. And this sort of came as kind of a notion in my head. I was like, well, what if I tried to simplify the degree? So that instead of doing every little thing that you'd have to do for a degree, the focus was, could you pass the final exams? And then later I added on programming projects for the classes that had them. And this was sort of the kind of skeleton of an MIT degree, but, you know, pursued in a rather unconventional way. You know, no credit, obviously, just the knowledge that you gain. But this was sort of the first big ultra learning project I did. And it probably is still my most popular one today. This is the one that people probably know me most for.
Yeah.
But I think that, yeah, there was a lot of assumptions about how you do school. And so my feeling now, you know, this is about 8 years later going through that project. I wouldn't say that every single individual listening to this right now could necessarily do exactly that project and have success with it. I think it all depends on your different background and strategies and also your natural aptitude and this kind of thing. But I definitely feel like the assumption that school has to take place over 4 years, or that it requires doing all of this to get skills that are useful for your professional life, is just completely false. And so especially if you decide what you want to get out of your learning experience, you can very often go straight for that and avoid a lot of the fluff.
If you want a learning platform that will help your learners get past the fluff and go straight for the most relevant content, be sure to check out our sponsor for this quarter. Calm Partners helps learning businesses conceive, develop, and fulfill their online education strategy. Their solutions begin with Elevate LMS, an award-winning learning platform that provides a central knowledge community and drives learner engagement. To extend the value of Elevate, Calm Partners provides a wide range of online education services, including curriculum design, instructional design, fully managed webinars, webcasts, live stream programs, and virtual conferences. Find out more at leadinglearning.com/compartners. And now back to the interview, as Jeff asks Scott to say more about what readers can expect from Ultra Learning.
Well, I love having you around as a, you know, walking, talking, living, breathing example of just how much you can do with self-directed learning if you're committed to doing it. And that's obviously one story that you tell in Ultra Learning, about the MIT challenge, but you cover a lot of other people's stories, other ultra learners. Can you tell listeners a bit more about just, you know, what to expect from the book? What kind of things do you cover in it?
Sure. So the bulk of the book is divided into what I call 9 principles of ultra learning, which are really kind of principles of learning themselves, although they take on somewhat a bit different flavor when we're thinking about ultra learners who are pursuing learning kind of from a self-directed standpoint and willing to kind of go to somewhat more extreme methods to get the results. And so the 9 principles for me were very important because I think each of them embodies both a lever that you can use to get better results. So if you are not applying it very well right now, if you can make modifications to what you're doing, you can get better results. But they also kind of, the opposite of the principles is a common mistake. So 2 of the ones that I've been bringing up a lot in interviews, because I think they have some really interesting scientific research behind them, are what I call directness and retrieval. So directness is really the kind of converse of what psychologists know as the problem of transfer. Basically, we have known for decades now that if you take people and you put them in a class and get them to study something and then get them to apply it on something that is superficially different but really involves all the stuff that they learned in the class, they often do abysmally. And this is really disappointing because the entire idea of classroom education is that we are teaching our students, our learners, how to perform in the real world. You know, they're, and maybe those performing is not necessarily a professional skill, but even if you teach a history class, we would expect someone who's been through that history class to be able to reason about historical events or to have some assumptions about how the world works. And a lot of times these things show weaknesses. So some really interesting examples of this. In one study, students who took a high school psychology class did no better on a college level psychology class. In another one, economics majors did no better on questions of economics reasoning than did non-economics majors. And I mean, these are pretty obvious transfer issues. And so a lot of the issues in my mind spring from the fact that we have this metaphor of learning that our brain is like a muscle and it doesn't really matter what you practice on, it's going to make it stronger. And this just doesn't seem to be how the brain works, that what we learn tends to be quite specific, at least in the beginning, before you build up lots and lots of knowledge. And so this means that as an ultra learner, or as the principle of directness would suggest, if you can learn with a direct connection to the area you eventually want to apply the skill, you avoid a lot of these problems. Mm. So if you want to learn a language to speak it, you should be practicing conversations much, much earlier than most classes encourage. Or if you want to learn programming and you want to do it because you're going to make a website, you should start making a website rather than just working meticulously through some programming book. And so again, this trade-off, I think, is very important, because very often we settle down for some easier abstracted task, or even just classrooms, because they don't know all the varied ways people want to use a skill. We'll teach it in a one-size-fits-all level. And so it's up to the learner to kind of tailor that back to the situation they want to use it. So that would be one of the principles. Another principle, which I, again, found really fascinating, the research, is retrieval. So retrieval is the process of summoning up things from your memory as opposed to looking at them. And in one really interesting study conducted by Jeffrey Karpicki, who's done a number of interesting studies on retrieval, and Janelle Blunt, they took students and separated them into different categories. So one of the categories, they got them to do repeated reviews. So that meant that they had a text and they just read it over and over again. And then they had another group, and they asked them to do free recall. So after they finished reading it, they'd shut the book and try to recall as much as they could from memory. And the really interesting twist of this study is they asked the students after they did this, how well did you learn the material? And the interesting thing is that it's the repeated reviewers who said that they learned it the best. They said, you know what, I've got this. But when you actually test them, it's the free recallers, it's the people who practice retrieval that perform much, much better, even though they thought they had learned the material worse. And so I think this is very funny, because this kind of points to a cognitive quirk that very often we judge our own learning in ways that are not entirely accurate, and that can lead us to spend tons and tons of time doing learning activities, and then we get to a test or a real usage situation and find out that the knowledge doesn't transfer, or the knowledge doesn't apply, or it's not even available in memory, and we get really disappointed.
And I'm so glad you brought up retrieval, because I think out of all the things that I've learned about learning over time, you know, to apply to my own learning, finally getting it about retrieval probably made the biggest difference of just about anything I can think of. In fact, I'm going to be delivering a keynote in a couple of weeks. And I mean, just today, I've been in the process of basically engaging in retrieval, because I basically have to memorize, you know, an hour long speech and be able to get up and deliver that. And so going through that process of making myself try to remember, you know, what I was trying to say, where, and not just reading over the page again and again, which I know isn't going to get it into my memory. And you know, back to your earlier point about learning can be hard, it takes effort. I mean, that, you know, that almost feels like doing push-ups or something. It's not pleasant at times, but it's what's going to pay off in the end.
So I'll just add, because I think your example of bringing up doing a keynote is so funny, because I just recently gave a speech, and I was giving a speech about the topics in this book, telling some personal stories. And it was a big speech, and I was rehearsing a lot, and my wife happened to come along with me. And so she heard me rehearse this speech probably like four or five times. It was a half hour talk. So she was joking to me when I was giving it. She's like, I know your speech down. Like, I know everything about it. And she was joking, I could give your speech. Like, I know it entirely now. And I, you know, I'm just teasing her a little bit, but I was like, okay, all right, let's see you do the speech. And so after I did the speech, when we were in the hotel room, she did a little rendition of it, and she's like, oh wow, this is actually really hard. And I'm like, this is retrieval in action, because when I was practicing it, I have to rehearse it from memory, whereas you're just listening to me say it, and they are not the same cognitive process. And one of them is linked to really good memory and one of them is not. However, just as what happened in the study, almost like, you know, to a word, my wife was convinced that she knew the whole speech, because she just heard it on and on and on for like the week that I was practicing it. So I think this is a really interesting point. And your point about effort and difficulty, there's even a concept in the retrieval literature by R.A. Bjork known as desirable difficulty, which shows that more difficult retrieval results in better memory. So this kind of fits into this ultra learning picture that we're talking about.
Yeah. So I'm waiting for all that retrieval to fully pay off.
Absolutely.
You gotta do it. Well, and I'm intrigued, you know, for the sake of listeners, I know you tried to find some commonalities across the ultra learners, who you wrote about. I mean, are these people who kind of just intuitively get the principles that you're writing about, or, you know, to what extent had they learned to learn? To what extent did they just figure it out themselves? What's kind of common across these people who, you know, engaged in ultra learning and were successful at doing it?
Yeah. So obviously there are people, I think, that understand the learning process well. And so I think Benny Lewis, for instance, clearly understands the language learning process in a fair bit of depth. Some of that's probably trial and error. I think he speaks like over 10 languages. And so some of that's probably just hard won trial and error, as well as some of the people that I documented, such as Roger Craig, is, you know, familiar with spacing research. And that was a big part of his process of getting really good at Jeopardy. He's a character, for those of you who don't know, he's a character that I introduced in the book, who had a really incredible story about basically building a website to become really good at Jeopardy. And he became, I think, the highest single day winner at the time from just sort of like hacking the Jeopardy trivia process. But the thing about ultra learning in itself is that when we talk about it with these really dramatic stories, it can feel kind of unapproachable, that this is some mythic people that are doing this. But in having conversations with people who have read through the book, the feeling that I often get is people say, oh yeah, this is what I was doing when I got good at X. So I had a conversation with James Clear, who wrote the foreword to my book, and he was like, well, I never thought of myself as an ultra learner, but this is exactly what I did to get good at photography. Or I'll talk to someone who says, you know what, when I was learning dance in school, this is how I got really good at it. And the thing I find is that it's not that these principles are so distant, so out of line of how you might have experienced things. I'm not talking about some completely alien method, but rather I'm trying to illustrate what are the principles behind when you have learned something successfully and taught yourself something well versus when you didn't. And I think if you can understand what are those principles, then it's not like it just has to happen by happenstance. You can say, oh, well, if I want to learn X, I know these ingredients need to be in place. And so I can make sure they're in place rather than spend months banging my head against a wall when I don't see progress.
And I mean, is that really sort of the message for maybe I've called them the average learner who reads the book, who maybe isn't going to take on, you know, the big ultra learning challenges, but just simply wants to be a better learner? Is this just a sort of an ongoing reference for them to go back to and say, you know, am I doing these things in my learning to be more successful with it?
Well, I think my feeling about the book and the kind of hidden message is that I think that we all have the potential to be ultra learners. Now, this doesn't mean that we're all going to become Albert Einstein and win Nobel Prizes and accomplish big things. But the message of ultra learning, of teaching yourself difficult skills or skills that feel difficult for you right now and learning them well on your own, is something that I think is available to all people if they approach it the right way. And so the idea here is to, first of all, get some confidence, because there are probably things in your past that you have learned well. You just maybe weren't aware of why you learned that well. And I think, again, it goes back to, a lot of us are very quick to, you know, blame talent or blame, you know, oh, it was a bad teacher or this, when often there were the ingredients there, they just didn't line up perfectly and they didn't know how to apply them perfectly. And so for me, again, I'm not saying that everyone listening to this is going to want to learn four languages in a year or do the MIT challenge or do something really crazy. But that doesn't mean that they can't learn something that matters to them and learn it well and learn it deeply and do so by applying the right principles. So for me, I you know, as much as I have these big stories, I think of smaller ones like Dinah Faisenfeld, who was this New Zealand librarian I worked with, who, as she was nearing the end of her career, was saying, you know what, they don't need librarians anymore. Like, there's budget cutbacks and all these kinds of things. But instead of just lying down, she decided, you know what, what they do need is that there's all this data now. And so she needs to take her librarian skills into the 21st century. And so she actually learned statistical programming and data visualization near the end of her career, and became quite indispensable and being able to do jobs that she couldn't do before. So I think for every, you know, triumphal story that I can talk about, there's many, many more ordinary cases of people just challenging themselves to learn something that feels difficult for them right now and making a change in their career or lives as a result.
And I'm glad you mentioned that story, because I think the story about Diana is such a useful, practical one that I think anybody now should take to heart, because everybody's job and career is going to change. You know, they're rapidly changing.
Absolutely.
And you're going to have to figure out how to adapt as those changes happen. And that was just a great example of somebody who did that. So I'm glad you shared that. I'd love to know about you in this whole process, because I've written books before, and I know that, you know, writing a book in and of itself is kind of like an ultra learning project.
Very much.
I mean,
so,
what did you learn new in this process?
Well, so it's funny because probably about a year or two before I started writing this book, I had had this idea that I wanted to learn more about cognitive science. I was already doing a lot of work on learning, and so I wanted to have kind of a deeper understanding of both, you know, the psychology behind it, but also cognitive science, generally speaking. And I'd started by reading some books and stuff, but then it eventually morphed into this project. And so when I knew I was going to write a book about learning, it was like, okay, now is my chance to really dig in deep and explore these subjects to a level of depth that, you know, if I were just casually, I'm not going to just casually print off 23 different journal papers and read them through and try to make sense of, you know, the literature on feedback timing or something like this. So this was really an opportunity for me to try to dig into the science, especially as someone who's a non-researcher. Like, I am a learning enthusiast as opposed to a learning expert. And I feel like this was really my opportunity in this book to try to learn as much as I can about how the mind works. And more than just trying to quote a few random studies, I felt like I really wanted to try to get a sense of what is the broader picture being painted by all of this research of how we learn and how our minds work and what are the factors involved, so that, you know, when we're thinking about learning methods and stuff, what things make sense and what things kind of fit and jive with that picture.
Okay. And before we kind of wrap up talking about ultra learning, we referenced this a little bit at the beginning of the conversation, but most of the folks who are listening here serve lifelong learners, and mostly through providing a pretty traditional continuing education, professional development type experiences. So, an expert standing up in front of the room, delivering the information, knowledge, hoping some of that transfer happens. How would you advise that group, this group of listeners, how can they best make use of ultra learning?
Well, only half jokingly, you can tell everyone in the audience to buy my book. No, yeah.
They should definitely.
I think one of the things that you can do as an educator, if you are aware of these principles of learning and how things work, is that you can become a facilitator for people. I think there's an old expression, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. And I think it's the same is very much true of learning, that you can present someone with resources and materials, but you can't make them learn. That has to be something that goes on inside the student's mind, him or herself. And so for me, what I feel when we are working with students and working with educators is that part of our responsibility is also to say, hey, here's what you would have to do to get good at this. And this is what I'm going to be able to provide you, but this is also what I'm not going to be able to provide you. So for instance, when we're talking about directness, it's like, I can give you some of these ideas and I can, you know, follow up with you if you want some feedback on how you can apply it, but recognize that you need to start thinking about how you want to apply this as you're listening, or it's very easily going to just slip out or become kind of inert knowledge. Similarly, with issues of retrieval, if you are teaching students something, say, hey, if you were studying for this course, this is how to study for it. You know, test yourself this way. Don't just read over your notes. And so I think it's kind of unfortunate that at the culture at large, a lot of these findings from educational psychology, they have trickled down to teachers, but much more rarely have they trickled down towards learners. So that, you know, even for me going through this research and spending tons of time learning this, there were still interesting findings that I wasn't aware of. Whereas as students, you know, they're like the people in the study that I mentioned, that they're off reviewing their notes over and over again and then wondering why their test grades don't improve. And so I think part of our goal as educators should not just be to give people content knowledge, but also to give them the pointers and tools so that they can take that content knowledge and turn it into real world skills.
Yeah, I think that's just an important message that just generally doesn't get conveyed, at least in my experiences in continuing education and professional development settings. So I think it's something that we do need to be more consistent, more persistent about moving forward. Mm-hmm. So I'll ask, in wrapping up the conversation around the book, what's next for you? Where are you going to be focusing now that you've, I know you're going to be out there obviously promoting the book, but I assume you probably have some sort of next mountain to climb in mind.
Oh, I have too many mountains. Like, people have been asking me this question, and the honest truth is that, like, my list of projects I'd like to take on is so long right now that it's just going to be a question of which one comes next and which one fits my schedule. Some of the things that I've wanted to work on, I've wanted to do a project with chess. I want to do one with oil painting, with music, either guitar or piano. I'd like to do some kind of physical skill, but I haven't figured out exactly which one I would want to do. I was learning some skiing, but not really ultra learning it. And I've also, I have some interest in improving my own professional skills. So my own skills as a writer, for instance, is something that I've been very interested in, because a lot of my projects are going from scratch to some level of ability. Whereas I think it's also a very interesting thing to explore going to something that you've done for over a decade, and how do you get to the next level of ability? You know, and then also all the skills that I've been working on for a while. So I finished learning languages after my trip. But you know, those are still a big part of my life and something that I care about continuing practicing and continuing learning. So really, I think the question is, what won't I be trying to learn next after this book is done?
Well, I look forward to reading about it, because I'm assuming you will be writing about it as you settle in on whatever's next.
I will try to do my best. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we're at the point where, I usually ask a question that we ask of all guests, and I emailed you about this ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And in your case, it's kind of a loaded question. It's quite unusual, because the question is, what is one of the most powerful learning experiences you've been involved in as an adult since finishing your formal education? And obviously this is like the heart of everything you do. So I'd love to hear how you answer that question.
Well, which one do you want me to talk about? I think I'll talk about the language learning project that I did, because we did spend a little bit of time talking about my MIT challenge project, although that obviously had a huge influence on me. But the language learning project, just to continue with my example, when I met Benny Lewis and I was struggling with learning French, I do feel after I had that encounter with him and I changed my method a bit, I did reach an okay level in French after spending a year there. But I really left with this feeling that much more was possible, that if you didn't let an English bubble form around you, if you just only spoke in the language that you were trying to learn, you would quickly habituate everyone around you to just speaking in that language, or at least accepting that you're going to speak in that language around them. And so I managed to convince this friend of mine. He was actually my roommate at the time, and he was pretty skeptical, but I convinced him to join me on this trip. And we went to Spain, Brazil, China, and Korea to apply this no English rule to each of these places for about 3 months each in each country. And I got to say that it was transformative for me, not only because I felt after 3 months in Spain, our Spanish was much better than my French was after a year in France. But the surprising thing was is that this approach was actually easier. And so the difficulty of understanding that, I think, comes from most people view the first like week or two of total immersion, because that is difficult. But what they don't recognize is when you do partial immersion, there's always this starting and stopping. And so the metaphor that I really like that someone else brought up in one of these other conversations I've had is that it's a little bit like diving into cold water versus having someone splash it on you repeatedly. That yes, diving into cold water is cold for that first few minutes, but then your body habituates. Whereas if you get splashed with cold water repeatedly, every splash hurts. And so I think often when we are dealing with learning, especially learning hard skills, frustration and fear and difficulty and all these emotional things can really overwhelm us. And if you have this start, stop, start, stop, start, stop approach to it, you often don't get over that. You often still have that resistance to doing it. Whereas when you approach it with an ultra learning project, whether it's immersion or just diving right into whatever you're doing, you get that exposure therapy, you habituate to whatever the difficulty is, and then you get to the fun part where you are actually improving. And so when we were on this trip, we were studying hard and we were learning hard, but we were also living our lives in these other countries and experiencing these other cultures. And it's an experience I would highly recommend everyone try if they have the opportunity to take a couple months to travel or live somewhere. It's truly life-changing, but I think it's something that more people should try.
Well, I was envious when I read about that one in the book, being both a lover of languages and a lover of travel. So kudos to you for doing that and for having the opportunity for doing that. And of course, you share more stories like that from yourself and from many others in Ultra Learning. So definitely recommend that listeners get that. If people listening want to know more about you, the work you do in general, and of course about the book, where's the best place to go?
So I recommend going to my website, which is scotthyoung.com. That's scotthyoung.com. I also have links to the book there if you're interested in buying it. The book is published by Harper Business, so it should be available in all retail locations. If you want to get it on Amazon or something, if you just Google Ultra Learning, it should show up for you and you should be able to get the book. There's also an audio version of the book, which I narrate. So I know a lot of podcast listeners prefer to listen than to read. So if you want to just continue listening to me talking about learning and how to do it better, then that would be what I'd recommend.
That's so nice that you got to narrate your own book. I was not even offered that option. So that's I think I would have preferred
it. I had to fight for it, but I got it. Yeah.
Well, good for you. Well, great. Thank you. Scott, this has just been a fascinating conversation. You do fascinating work. Again, I definitely highly recommend that folks get the book. And thank you again for being a guest on the Leading Learning Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
That concludes the interview with Scott H. Young. You'll find show notes at leadinglearning.com/episode198.
And when you check out those show notes, you'll also see various options for subscribing to the podcast. And if you're getting value out of what you hear, we'd be truly grateful if you would subscribe, as it helps us to get some data on the impact of what we're doing.
We'd also be grateful if you would take a minute to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. Go to leadinglearning.com/Apple. That will put you in the right place. Jeff and I personally appreciate your rating and review, but even more importantly, reviews and ratings help the podcast show up when people search for content on leading a learning business.
And we'd be truly grateful if you check out our sponsors for this quarter. Find out more about Authentic Learning Labs at leadinglearning.com/authentic, and find out what Comm Partners has to offer at leadinglearning.com/commpartners.
Finally, please tell others about the podcast. You can send a tweet by going to leadinglearning.com/share. You can also like us on Facebook and share us there. You can find us at facebook.com/leadinglifelonglearning. However you do it, please spread the good word about leading learning.
So thanks again, and we'll see you next time on the Leading Learning Podcast.